The following program is sponsored. The opinions and statements made by the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
Here on the John Fredericks Radio Network, Curtis Sellis, a senior advisor with American First Policies and America First Policies Action, the number one, numero uno and only political action committee that is sanctioned by President Trump himself. Curtis, great to have you.
Hey, it's great to be here, John. My phone's working today. We tried to do this last week, but my phone wouldn't cooperate.
I know, because it's a Huawei phone. Now, Huawei gremlins were in there. They've been, especially you, because you've been so critical of the Chinese. I mean, I bet they got all your phones bugged and everything else. Your house bugged, your car, everything.
That's right. I'm sure they're listening now. John Fredericks' show has a whole new bunch of listeners. 1.5 billion Chinese are listening right now
because they're listening to your phone, Curtis.
Yes.
Now, the president going to the G20, I thought it was an enormously successful meeting that he had at the G20 summit. And basically, he sat down with a dictator Xi, and he said, look, we have a relationship. He's a nice guy, but we'll see what happens. If they don't come to the table with a good deal, there'll be no deal. What say you?
Well, that's right, and he stuck to that. He stuck to that. What we have now, China agreed to resume negotiating with the U.S. toward a comprehensive, enforceable agreement that achieves, as President Trump said, a balanced trading relationship between the U.S. and China. He said to Xi's face, we must have a balanced trading arrangement. It's been one way so far, and that cannot continue. It's very interesting that before this meeting, China had put out, the Chinese government, high-level officials in the government had said, as a precondition for resuming talks, all tariffs had to be lifted, and Huawei, the Chinese telecommunications company, which is actually a cyber espionage arm of the People's Liberation Army, right, had to be taken off the U.S. blacklist, which prevents American companies from doing business with Huawei. Well, President Trump did neither of those things, yet China came back to resume negotiations. The tariffs that had been at 10% and then went up to 25% on May remain in place at 25%. Mm-hmm. The president said he would postpone indefinitely proposed tariffs on $300 billion of additional goods imported from China. Those tariffs have been postponed indefinitely while these talks resume. Huawei remains on the blacklist. Mm-hmm. Now, what the president said was companies, American companies, could sell equipment to Huawei as long as that equipment does not pose a threat to national security. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what was in place before. There's always been, when Huawei was placed on the blacklist, companies could apply for a license to, essentially an exemption and a license to sell goods if and when the Commerce Department determines it's not a national security threat. So if we want to sell them chips for them to make their crappy, cheap smartphones, they can do that. We can do that. But we could do that before. So the president essentially gave up nothing. And what he gained in return, besides the Chinese coming back to the negotiating table to play footsie, whack-a-mole, and rope-a-dope, actually the president's playing rope-a-dope with the Chinese. They have higher tariffs than they had in May. Those have not been repealed. What we gained is American businesses now have more time to reconfigure their supply chains and get out of China before the next round of tariffs on $300 billion worth of goods, which are mostly consumer goods affected on that last round of proposed tariffs. They now have more time to get their supply chains out of China and move them back to America, back to the Western Hemisphere where they belong. It's interesting, by saying he is postponing the tariffs indefinitely. Well, indefinitely could mean forever, right? In that the tariffs that are in place will be there forever. So you see, if he had said, I'm going to postpone these tariffs for 90 days, some of these idiot corporate leaders would say, oh, well, in 90 days, all the tariffs are going to go away because there's going to be a deal. So let's not move our supply chains. Let's not move our factories out of China. But by saying it's going to be postponed indefinitely, that means we don't know when there's going to be a deal. And any responsible corporate manager would be looking for the exits, would have already been out the exits of China. You know, it's funny, John. Back in 2012, the Japanese started moving their supply chains out of China. They had a little tiff with China over the Senkaku Islands, some rocks in the East China Sea that China claims sovereignty to and Japan claims sovereignty to. And I don't know, some boats bumped into each other or something like that. And the Chinese went on an anti-Japanese jihad and started whipping up sentiment, and they started serving papers on the Japanese factories in China as part of this propaganda effort and nationalistic effort targeting the Japanese. So the Japanese got the message. And they started moving their factories and their supply chains out of China so they weren't dependent on China.
Right.
Look, but did the Americans now, the American companies ought to be getting that same message. The Chinese Communist Party has declared people's war on the U.S. after the president raised tariffs to 25%. And the Chinese People's Liberation Army said, wouldn't it be nice if we sank a battleship and killed thousands of Americans? They are not our friends. It is obvious. Everybody knows that. And look, no responsible business leader would let his company, his business, be hostage to a sole supplier. You always look for a diversified base of suppliers. Because if you're dependent on one supplier, that supplier's got you by the short hairs, right? They can raise prices. They can cut you off. They can go to a different customer to sell their goods to at a better price, and you're up the creek without a paddle, right? So every responsible business leader always looks for diversification in their suppliers. So they're not, if a natural disaster hits and a meteor strikes that factory of their supplier, they've got other places to go to, right? Well, what these American geniuses, business leaders have gotten into by putting all of their factories in China, all their eggs in one basket, they've now become dependent on a sole supplier. And it's called the Communist Party of China. The Chinese Communist Party.
Right.
That's ridiculous. Investors should be asking the corporate leaders, are you diversified? Have you diversified away from China? And if the answer is no, it's like, well, I'm selling your stock. I don't want to be invested in your company because you're doing a crappy job of leading it. That's where we're at. So So it's very interesting. And, you know, for these companies that are whining, oh, well, we can't do this. Oh, decoupling from China is hard. Moving supply chains is hard. It is not, it's not impossible. It's hard. Well, that's why you earn the big bucks, my friends.
Right.
And it's not impossible, and it's not unprecedented. Remember, these companies decoupled from the United States 20 years ago, 30
right.
years ago, and they decoupled millions of Americans from good-paying jobs.
Right.
So, you know, it's time for them to decouple away from communist China and back to America and stop
right.
whining about it.
And in that time, they reaped the benefits of cheap labor, cheap cost of production, and made a lot more money and a lot more bonuses. And now they got to step up, is what you're saying. Curtis Ellis with us. Curtis Ellis, longtime operative in the Trump campaign, 2015 and 16. He also served in the Department of Labor, and he's now a senior advisor to America First Policies. Curtis, let me ask you this. It seems like the cornerstone of your position here is that when the president said that during the negotiation he will now suspend the additional $300 billion in tariffs that he was going to impose, he will suspend those indefinitely. Basic crux of your position here is that that means that he will also indefinitely continue with the first $250 billion of tariffs that he's already levied on the Chinese 7 or 8 months ago, right? I mean, that's a basic
exactly.
position, right? That,
yeah.
that if you just look at it and said, oh, well, the president says he's not going to impose any additional tariffs, and there's not a 90-day or 120-day, but that means the tariffs that are in place stay. Because
that's
there's
right.
no timeline
exactly.
on those either.
The tariffs that are in place stay indefinitely.
Right, indefinitely. indefinitely. So there's no timeline to review those either, which means that if you're doing business in China right now and you've set up a company there or moved your company there and that's where your supply chain is based, you're now faced with these in perpetuity. So it's time to get out.
That's right.
Is that your position?
Look, businesses want certainty. Well, here's the certainty. You're going to have 25% tariffs on stuff made in China. That's
right.
a certainty.
Right.
That's a certainty. You know, I get a kick out of this. We're told incessantly on CNBC and these geniuses with the MBA programs and everything, business wants certainty, business wants certainty. Well, you know what? There is no certainty in life. There are very few certainties. Death and taxes, Benjamin Franklin said. And, you know, everybody wants certainty. I think families deserve certainty, too. Or that's why you can have a family if I'm certain that I've got a job and I'll be able to raise the kids. You have certainty and you can raise a family. Businesses want certainty, but they want the rest of us to live on the gig economy, right? Where you don't have anything. You don't know what you're going to get. If somebody calls for Uber, well, maybe I'll get paid today as an Uber driver. If they don't call, I'm out of luck. So, you know, farmers don't have certainty. Farmers, look at the farmers and the ranchers. They plant a crop. They don't have certainty the rains are going to come. They don't have certainty that the price that they're going to be able to get for their crop on the harvest, if the fields aren't flooded and they can even get in the fields and harvest their crop, that the price they're going to get is going to be a good price or a bad price. So, yeah, we want certainty, but you know, let's put it in context. There's a lot of uncertainty in this world. So why should the business certainty, the businesses that crave certainty, why should they get it at the expense of American workers and other people?
But, absolutely.
Yeah, here's a certainty for you, business leaders. There's going to be 25% tariffs as far as the eye can see, and the other certainty is get out of China.
Well, that's really the message, and that's been the president's message from day one. That's why these tariffs are not going away. But, of course, the Republican Wall Street bedwetters, the pee pants leggers, are saying, oh, my God, we're not going to win because we're going to lose. We can't win a majority now because of this China tariffs. And the Wall Street Journal says we're going to go into it's going to be a disaster, and farmers are going to go lose money, and everybody's upset over these tariffs. And they're never going to go away, and let's just make it all go away. So they're peeing their pants here on a daily basis. But the economy is booming, and so the tariffs that are in place are bringing in money. And we're evening the playing field, right?
Right, exactly. And there are so many moving parts of the economy. These people that claim they can predict with absolute 100% certainty that these tariffs are going to cause higher prices for consumers, I mean, that's BS, total BS. Look, First of all, we see no evidence for inflation. There was another consumer price and producer price index and intermediate goods price index came out the other day. No inflation whatsoever. 5 out of 10 of China's top exports, 5 of their 10 top exports to the U.S. are also made in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And these are Mexico's top exports. So, hey, here, you economist genius, here's another Econ 101. Competition leads to lower prices, right? So if China is got a competitor in Mexico to produce the same things they're selling to America, China's going to absorb the cost of the tariffs. Otherwise, they will lose that customer to Mexico, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So this whole idea that the tariffs are inevitably going to lead to higher prices for consumers is based on a complete fallacy, a lie, or an assumption that there is only one supplier for that goods, that there is no competition, and that's wrong. That's not true. Or how about this? I guess Walmart is going to raise its prices. Well, I guess that means, I guess we should assume then that Walmart got on the phone with the people from Costco and the people from Target and said, and the people from Kmart and said, let's all raise our prices at once. Otherwise, what happens if Walmart raises its prices? People go shop at Costco. People go shop at Kmart, right?
Or Target.
It assumes that Walmart and Costco and Kmart all get the same goods from the same person, from the same company.
It's
fantasy land.
It's
fantasy
propaganda. Land. Look, the Wall Street Journal's already started with two articles that come out online today. I mean, it's just propaganda from Wall Street because they just want this all to go away. I mean, their life was great when we had cheap labor, cheap goods of production. Everybody made more money and they got bigger bonuses. That's what this whole thing was about. And so now they're whining and pee-peeing down their leg because we still have tariffs and this meeting with President Xi. And look, here's what the president said, Curtis Ellis. He said, we're going to continue the negotiations and see how it goes. And we have a good relationship. And if the negotiations go well, then that's good. We can move forward. If they don't, then we'll have to continue down the path we're on. He said, but, you know, if they lie to me again, basically he inferred this, if they lie to me again, I'll just walk away from the table again, like I did the last time. So we'll see what happens, right? We'll see what happens. Curtis, two more minutes. I want to change topics a minute. The Democratic debate, who was the big winner? Who was the big loser? Sum it up.
I think Joe Biden was a big loser. He looked like a robot. He talks like a robot. He talks like Chatty Cathy. You pull the string and the same voice comes out all the time. He's interesting. He couldn't I'm glad he defended states' rights. He put out the busing. Julian Castro to me looks like a space alien, but that's a whole other issue. It's just ridiculous that the Democrats were the huge losers there. Therefore, open borders, no border enforcement whatsoever, decriminalize all this border crossing, and give everybody free health care. Doctors tell you if you mix prescription drugs, you can have unwanted and bad reactions. If you mix the policy prescriptions of these Democrats, open borders plus free health care for anybody who shows up at our border, that's going to be a very bad interaction. You're going to have a billion people showing up at our border to flying in and showing up at Kennedy Airport or someplace in order to cash in the chit for free health care. And only the sickest people will come, right? Because if you're well, you don't have a reason to come to America.
Right.
But if you're not well in Bangladesh and you can't get help at the hospital in Dhaka, what you do is you find your way to the United States where you're going to have a free doctor at your disposal.
It's insane policies putting their hands up. So they want open borders and free health care for the people who come through the open borders. And the rest of us, I guess, just pay for it out of the goodness of our heart until the entire country goes bankrupt. So,
right. We can't even figure out how to provide decent health care to 300 million Americans. They're going to take away your private insurance, and we get to pay for free health care or health care for a billion people on Earth, 6 billion people on Earth. That's bizarre. Why don't we just provide doctors in Guatemala, in Central America, in El Salvador, in Honduras, as Julian Castro pronounces it, and save them the trip for coming here? Why don't we just set up clinics and hospitals down there?
And pay for it all.
Yeah,
and pay for it all. Dollars. Take it from the middle class and just say, hey, you have a new tax. You're going to pay another, I don't know, $10 a day or something. And we're going to ship all these doctors down to Central America because that's who we are. That's their best line. It's not who we are. This is who we are. I don't know what that means. It's not who we are.
Yeah, open, I mean, look, they've got Hallmark cards. They don't have policy proposals. They don't have policies. They have Hallmark greeting cards. They have Hallmark moments. That's who we are.
All right,
congratulations, graduate. You've got free college now.
You know? Curtis, we're going to the top of the hour. Curtis Ellis, always good to have you with us, Curtis. Speaking of the phone lines, let's go to Colonel Mike in West Virginia. Colonel Mike, you're on the line.
Well, Colonel, welcome back to Savannah, one of my favorite places, too.
Isn't it a beautiful town? I mean, I've been
there really
times.
Gorgeous. I haven't been there in many, many years, but it's a really gorgeous
just,
place.
You know, walking around in the summer with the overhanging trees and, you know, as you know, when Sherman got to the coast, they talked him out of burning Charleston and Savannah. He'd not burn Savannah, although he burned everything else. General Sherman with the Union Army, they begged him, local officials begged him not to burn Savannah because of the beauty of it. And lore has it that General Sherman was taken aback. The war was over, but he was mm-hmm. taken aback by the beauty of the city and decided to spare it.
Well, it could be a fable, it could be true, but, you know, good thing he didn't do it. John, I'm calling today because I just heard, and this is probably propaganda central, Christopher Newport University has a lady on this morning on the news on another channel who's stating that, and this is something you got to investigate, and you could probably report on at a later date, that the white Republican college graduates, young millennials and beyond, and listen to the words she said, the way she said it. She said, they're moving to the Democratic Party in the Trump era. What the heck is that? The Trump era.
You know what? Let me tell you something. Look. And I've got Saxman on the line, too. Her name is Rachel Bitcoin. She is not a pollster. She's a Democratic operative that gets paid through University. The CNU polls have already discredited themselves over the last since Trump came into being. This is a poll that came out in 2016 that I went ballistic on when I was chairman, saying that Trump was at 32% in Virginia and Hillary was beating him 51-32 in the middle of October. They had they had Hillary up by 20 points. She won by 4. This is the nonsense they put out. Look, you can make any poll say whatever you want by skewering who you ask and what questions. She is not a pollster. She is a Democratic operative that basically is a complete liberal, a complete left winger that
has
a narrative.
She's a propagandist. That's what she's doing.
She has a narrative. It's a political narrative. It's not a poll. And the poll that she does is completely fraud. It's fraudulent. And she's a phony, and the poll's a phony.
Did Joseph get down to Florida? Did he play ball in Florida already?
Yeah, we already played 7 games. They were knocked out Monday. And he batted 450 and led his team in every offensive category.
Nice, real nice.
Yeah. So we hit.
Well, you guys have a happy 4th of July. No Saxman's on the phone. Have a great 4th of July. I'm glad you're moving closer because now Colonel Mike could come down instead of what's his name, Vivaldi, to Four Seasons. I come once once every season now. I'll come a little bit more.
If you want to. I'm off the week of. I'm taking some time off the week. The week of the 19th or something. Or was it the 15th?
Well, just text me. Let me know what you got. Because you're going to call me, and then you're going to call me again and say, well, so-and-so wants to come on. By the way, I found Martha Bonetta. I found Martha Bonetta. You know where she is?
Where?
On the side of a milk carton. They're still looking for her.
Listen, you pick a day you want to come down, and we get it done, right? Just text me.
All right, I'll talk to you. Bye-bye.
John Happy Fourth.
You're listening to the John Frederick Show. Common sense for the Commonwealth. Online anytime at thejohnfrederickshow.com.
John Frederick.
Meantime, the House GOP wetting their pants once again, pessimistic about recapturing the House majority next year. All of you Republicans out there, get a life and fight. Fight for the economy. Fight to get out of these wars. Fight for something.
Stay connected online and take him wherever you go. To get the free John Frederick Show app, follow on Twitter at JF Radio Show.
Oh no, Trump said another tweet. I'm going to pee-pee down my leg.
Has this administration...
Talk Radio, AM 600, 101.1 FM, WBOB.
With SRN News, I'm Gordon Griffin. A seismologist says two large earthquakes that were centered in the Mojave Desert in California caused less damage and fewer injuries because their epicenters were away from densely populated areas. But Lucy Jones of the California Institute of Technology warned Sunday that, on average, a quake of magnitude 6.0 or larger will hit Southern California every few years. The outcome would be worse if it happens on faults in metropolitan areas such as Hollywood. The U.S. women's national team will be honored for its Women's World Cup title with a parade in New York City on Wednesday. Shortly after the team's win Sunday in Lyon, France, Mayor Bill de Blasio announced plans for the parade on Twitter. It'll take place on a stretch of Broadway known as the Canyon of Heroes that's hosted many celebratory parades previously. More details at srnnews.com.
Maybe you'd like to know what exactly Relief Factor is. It was created by doctors. It's a 100% drug-free supplement with four key ingredients that simply help your own body deal with the natural inflammatory response that it has. It's easy to swallow, four little capsules in each packet, like the packet that I carry with me at all times. Three packets a day for a week, then two packets a day for 2 weeks, and I have just described the three-week quick start. And you will know in 3 weeks, that's the beauty of it, whether it works. They don't drag you on. That costs just $19.95. There's a very good chance that a very serious percentage of my listeners suffer from some sort of muscular or joint pain. You should try this for $19.95. That's all you can lose. If it works, they will send it to you automatically. If it doesn't work, tell them not to send any shipments. And it's as simple as that. It is all at ReliefFactor.com. I've been using it for years now. Relief Factor.
Wondering how you're going to entertain your children this summer? YMCA Camp Immokalee has you covered. They'll never be bored with activities like kayaking, archery, ziplining, and fishing. Lifelong friendships will be made through evenings spent by the campfire. The staff at Camp Immokalee is carefully selected and will be a wonderful role model for your children. By helping create a warm and diverse community, you'll find your child begging to stay just one more day at Camp YMCA. Visit FirstCoastYMCA.org.
Internal Revenue Service. When you owe a personal or business tax debt and can't pay, these three words bring feelings of fear and anxiety. Contact J. David Tax Law, recently voted best tax attorney in Jacksonville by Folio Weekly Readers and selected as a 2019 Ultimate Tax Attorney by the Jacksonville Business Journal. When you owe the IRS or Florida sales tax and can't pay, it's only a matter of time before tax liens, wage garnishments, or bank levies happen to you. Don't wait. Call J. David Tax Law for your no-cost consultation. We take the time to go through your tax problems step by step, explain your options, and how we will resolve your tax issues. Issue once and for all. See why J. David Tax Law was voted best tax attorney in Jax. Call now for a no-cost consultation. 904-507-4777. That's 904-507-4777. Or find us on the web at jdavidtaxlaw.com. Peace of mind is only a click or phone call away.
Ask an attorney about Florida law.
WBOB and The Answer invites you to join Joseph Pippin Saturday mornings at 8. He'll answer your questions about Florida state planning, Medicaid, divorce, family law, guardianship, adoption, tax law, and personal injury. Call attorney Joe Pippin Saturday mornings at 8. Right here, WBOB, The Answer.
Now, John Frederick's Radio Network Ann Patterson joining us now, former ambassador to Egypt and Pakistan. Ann Patterson, also the current president of the U.S. Qatar Council. She formerly served as U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs 2013 through 2017. And she is with us now. Ambassador Patterson, thank you for being with us this morning. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Oh, my goodness, Ambassador. I don't know where to start. Let's start with the G20 and move, I guess, east or west or north. We'll have to figure it out. The president, first sitting president to step foot into North Korea over the demarcation zone. What did
over the DMZ. So, John, I probably would part ways with some of my friends in the foreign policy establishment here, but I say let's give this a chance. Nothing's worked for decades. I mean, it's a really long shot that we can restrain, that President Trump can restrain North Korea's nuclear ambition. But I think you got to give the president credit for trying. So we'll see what happens. I do think it's a long shot, but no one else has a better idea. So let's just see how he works out. He's appointed this very experienced fellow, Steve Bagan, who's been around forever in foreign policy circles, to lead the negotiations under the supervision of the Secretary of State. So, again, nobody has a better idea. It's a national security priority. Let's see what happens.
You know, I agree with what you're saying, Ambassador, and I don't see the downside here, because the president said, look, in order to start any kind of a dialogue, you have to build a relationship. It's not like he's lifting the sanctions or he's changing anything based on, you know, a handshake meeting. But how do you go forward with any negotiations without building a dialogue, right?
Well, and to his credit, during the last meeting, he walked away.
Right.
And so that at least showed me that he wasn't going to take, he wasn't going to just, what's the right word? He wasn't going to play ball with this kid, the North Korean leader of North Korea, unless there was something positive that was going to happen. So I thought it showed a certain amount of both courage and imagination to go. I from being in the government for many years, though, I felt for the press and the security people who must have just been going crazy at the last-minute arrangements to cross over the DMZ.
Right.
But give the president a little credit on this one, I think.
What is the protocol there, Mrs. Ambassador? Why has no sitting president ever done that? Like, what is the, just walk us through that protocol.
Well, I'm sure, and this is where people have criticized the president relentlessly, is that you basically reinforce his rule of North Korea, and you reinforce his position by basically giving him the honor of having the president of the United States cross the DMZ into North Korea and treat him as an equal instead of the odious dictator that he is. But here's the other thing for me, is that South Korea has been one of our staunchest allies for many, many years.
Right.
And they want some kind of rapprochement with North Korea. And, of course, they're the ones in the crosshairs should anything happen. I mean, we the United States have a lot at risk, but nothing like the civilians that would be slaughtered in Seoul if there ever was a conflict. So that's the reason people don't do it, no previous presidents have done it. It would basically raise the prestige of Kim Jong-un. But again, no one has a better idea. Nothing's worked for decades, so let's see how this plays out.
Ms. Ambassador, walk us back to the Clinton era. Remember, there was a time where right there where President Clinton was considering a strike on North Korea. But then the concern he had was the conventional weapons that North Korea has across the DMZ, and his advisors were saying that it would turn Seoul into an inferno and hundreds of thousands of people would die. I mean, is that a real story?
That's a real story, and that's why this is almost an impenetrable problem. We have troops there that would be killed. We have American citizens that would be killed. But most of the city of Seoul is within artillery range of the DMZ. And people say, you know, wrongly in my view, that we could take out these artillery batteries before they attack. That's by everything I've read militarily, that seems impossible. Mm-hmm. So you would have massive, massive civilian casualties. And yes, we could probably destroy North Korea too, but you don't want the capital city of one of our major Asian allies to be utterly destroyed. There's almost no way out of this except by negotiation.
And so the president's giving up nothing, and now they're going to have a new set of negotiations. I agree with you, Ambassador Patterson. He's proved the last time, I think, they went to Vietnam, and things didn't go well. And the president thought that Kim Jong-un's demands were unreasonable, so he got up from the table and walked away.
I think he's actually had two meetings on this. So, but again, let's see how it plays out. The nuclear capacity, the intelligence apparently says that the North Koreans continue to build up their nuclear capacity. I don't doubt that that's true, but we have, I bet, a very good intelligence picture of what's going on in North Korea. And I think the deal the president's really offering North Korea is reintegration into the international community in exchange for giving up their nuclear ambitions.
I mean, it's hard to imagine they would do that because that really is what keeps him in power. But on the other hand, as many people have said, Miss Ambassador, if he can't feed his army, because right now, I think I was reading somewhere, they get a day off a week in order to rummage for food in the forest, probably isn't a prescription for long-term dominance, right?
No, it's not a prescription for long-term stability. And I'm sure, John, you and your listeners remember those pictures a few years ago of widespread famine in North Korea.
Yes.
I understand it's gotten quite a bit better. I mean, there's not mass starvation, but the economy's in really bad shape. And so he may find it in his interest to take the president up on this deal. And again, the South Koreans are not immaterial to this. They want to reduce that threat, and that should be important to us.
John Fredericks Radio Network, Truck the Truth Across America. We're live Fort Myers, Florida today. We're with Ambassador Ann Patterson. She's current president of the U.S. Qatar Council. Ann Patterson is also former U.S. ambassador to Egypt and Pakistan for the U.S., most recently serving under President Obama, Secretary of State of Near Eastern Affairs, 2013-17, with Secretary of State then John Kerry. Ambassador Patterson, let's get to the Middle East. The Kushner plan, basically, I know we talked about this a week ago, but I just don't see where this is going anywhere. They're basically trying to buy love from the Palestinians without a sovereign state. I guess it's a good try, $50 billion. You're trying to raise that. I guess kind of the same thing as North Korea, right? It's a good try. But I just don't see this getting the first base. What about you?
No, John. This I do disagree with the administration, quite apart from the politics, and we'll get to that. As far as I can tell, no one's really pledged a dime to support this plan. And they're trying to get American corporations interested in the plan. They're trying to get the Gulf involved. The plan was ambitious. And frankly, a lot of these projects have been on the drawing boards for years, and a lot of them were valuable. And some of them, frankly, we were doing before the administration cut off funding. But mm-hmm. So that's the first problem. There's no real funding for this plan. And the second problem is the political one. It was the meeting was boycotted by the Palestinians. They say this doesn't meet their political needs, which is some serious negotiations on the political side. So I just don't see where this is going. Plus, John, it's been tried at least twice before in my memory, and it faltered both times on the political side of it.
I don't see it. Let me tell you one other thing I thought was a little odd. At the other only thing at the G20 before we move on to some other things here is the president did actually meet with KSA Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. I don't know why he would sit down and meet with this guy after A, Khashoggi, and B, lied to him on the bat phone, point blank lied to the president. But I guess the president's position is KSA is a longtime ally, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the MBS is, I guess, come and go. Maybe he'll stay in power, maybe not. When his father dies, I think that's open for debate. So I guess he's going forward. But I don't know how you continue a relationship with a guy that murdered Jamal Khashoggi in that horrific manner and then got on the phone to the president, the leader of the free world, and lied to him.
So, John, that's what worries me, too. I mean, I understand that Saudi Arabia is a strategic ally, and the United States has to deal with people that aren't nice guys. I mean, that's been true forever. But what bothered me about the meeting was the praise that the president lavished on this young man. And my thought there is, first of all, he's proven to be extremely unpredictable and lying to the president and doing a lot of basically stupid and vicious things. And so I was fearful that the president would encourage that, not meaning to, of course, but the young man, the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, would take it as, wow, I've got the support of the president of the United States. Now I can do whatever I feel like. That was my worry about the meeting. Instead, he should have pressed this young man to release the women drivers. I mean, imagine women who want to drive are now in jail. And he could have pressed him to basically loosen up. And as far as I could see, I don't know what happened in private. He didn't do that. He just lavished praise on him.
Well, I wouldn't have done that in public. I thought that was the president's biggest mistake at that G20. I don't know why he had to do that. And I thought it was ill-advised. And, yeah, I get the relationship with the KSA, and I get the arms sales, and the president wants the money for the defense contractors. But that's another thing. You look at the money that Saudi Arabia has promised to spend and the money they did spend, and there's a big gap there. So I guess maybe they're dangling that. But at some point, and I also understand the president's position. Look, if they don't buy the weapons from us, they'll buy them from China. But, I mean, at some point you have to take a stand that it just isn't about weapon sales. So the whole thing felt uncomfortable to me.
No, and frankly, I don't really think to claim that they could buy it from China and Russia. But they're so invested in the U.S. defense system, and they need our support. They can't. I mean, they can't defend themselves with Chinese or Russian weapons. That's just crazy. They live entirely under the U.S. defense umbrella. All these countries in the Gulf live under the U.S. defense umbrella to export their oil and gas. And they're tied into the U.S. defense system. They need U.S. support to man and maintain the equipment they already have. So I wouldn't be too worried about that. But I do think, yes, you have to take a stand. And again, no reason to lavish praise on this young man. Because basically he's dangerous and unpredictable. And I would suspect that General Abizaid, Ambassador Abizaid, is trying very hard to curtail the young prince's worst instincts. I'm very glad General Abizaid is out there now.
Intemperance and incompetent is a toxic daily double, and that's the way I would define him. No question
Absolutely.
About it. Ambassador Ann Patterson, President, U.S. Qatar Council. Former Ambassador Egypt and Pakistan. Ambassador, let's get to Iran. Things have calmed down a little bit in the last few days with the president at the G20 summit. But the president also saying, look, I'll go meet with Iranian officials. I don't want war. I want to get this resolved, but you can't be shooting our drones down. But the president calling off the ill-advised strike by National Security Director John Bolton and the other neocon warmongers in there that wanted a strike on Iran. He said it would have, I guess they estimated a couple hundred people would have died, and the president called it off and saying that was a disproportionate response, mm-hmm. coupled with the fact that it's bombing a sovereign country. And the drone pieces, and I'm not defending Iran, but they were recovering drone pieces in their water, so it couldn't have been that far off for it to get there. What happens now?
So John, I think of course the president did the right thing by calling off the strike, but I don't think this is over yet. And there were articles in the press today about the terrible effect the U.S. sanctions are having on Iran's economy, particularly on the middle class. I'm sure they're not having any effects on the Iranian leadership, but on the middle class, people are losing their jobs, can't get food. I mean, very, very serious impact. So the president hopes this will bring him to the table. I'd be dubious about that because these countries can suffer a lot. So I think this is far from over. And now the Iranians are threatening to do even more to undermine the provisions of the Iranian nuclear agreement. So we'll see how that plays out. But I still think this is going to be a very volatile part of the world. The Europeans are trying to set up another system that will bypass the U.S. financial system. That doesn't seem to be going very well. So they're putting a lot of pressure on Iran. We'll see what Iran does, but I would suspect this is we're going to see this play out in an unfortunate way. I was relieved that the president decided not to proceed with the strike. Very relieved.
Oh, so was I. I mean, that just accomplishes nothing but ratchet things up, and then they have to respond to that. You know, what we need is, like you said, more negotiation. You're right. I remember being at the forum. Remember the Doha forum? Were you there?
I left right before that. I was at the Euromoney conference, yes.
That's right. That's right. And yeah. we interviewed the foreign minister of Iran, and, boy, he said something to me I'll never forget, because the question was posed to him about the sanctions and the suffering, high unemployment, no water. And the foreign minister of Iran, I'll never forget this answer. There were about 10 of us there, invited in journalists. And he said, we have been suffering under American sanctions and other things for 50 years. And our government has survived. It will continue to survive regardless of what the United States does. He said, we're a 1,000-year-old civilization. We will survive it. I think that's kind of buttresses what you just said. I mean, they can let their people suffer in order to get through this, and I think you're seeing that. All right, final question. Got a couple minutes. The Emir of Qatar is coming to Washington on July 9th. This is his third visit, unprecedented. And so the attitude towards the Emir and Qatar of the White House has changed dramatically since the president looked the other way during the blockade. I think he's now seeing the value of Qatar, the base we have there, and the Emir coming for a third visit. What do you look for next week in that visit by the Emir of Qatar, Mrs. Ambassador, to the White House?
Well, first let me say that the Emir of Qatar can come here, but it doesn't look like Mohammed bin Salman or Mohammed bin Zayed can come here, not because anything would really happen to them, but there could be an embarrassing situation. So what we look for, what I would look for, is a reaffirmation of the defense relationship in particular. And I think there are going to be some very interesting commercial deals signed, too. Because, of course, Qatar is expanding its natural gas capacity dramatically, $30 to $40 billion. It's going to reinforce its role as the world's largest supplier of LNG. And it's going to tie itself very closely with American corporations to do that. So I would expect to see some very interesting announcements that will create jobs in the U.S., a reaffirmation of the defense relationship. And then, of course, I would expect to see the president push Qatar and everybody else to resolve this rift in the Gulf. And from what I've seen, Qatar is absolutely willing to do that, but not willing to do that while it's being blockaded by its neighbors.
Ambassador Patterson, what changed in the White House? I mean, obviously, when the Gang of Four first went to the president and said they were going to do this blockade, obviously with the number one Air Force base, the biggest Air Force base in the region being there, and with a relationship with Qatar that we have, I mean, there's no doubt the administration waived it and said it was okay. And early on, the president did have a statement that he thought that Qatar was involved in funding terrorism. Now he's changed almost. He's almost done a 180 on it. What do you think it is that was the catalyst for that change in attitude at the White House and the Trump administration towards the blockade and towards the state of Qatar?
Well, I think two things, John. I think perhaps in the White House, remember, this, they were new, really, really new in government. I think perhaps in the White House, they didn't have a full understanding of the strategic importance of Al-Udeid. And so I think that was the first thing. I mean, Al-Udeid is absolutely essential to everything we do out there, particularly in Afghanistan. And I think maybe the second thing was the realization that some of the accusations being thrown against Qatar, like exporting terrorism or exporting extremism, I mean, I think there were people in the administration, perhaps most prominently Secretary of State Tillerson, that said, okay, what's good for the goose is good for the gander here. If we're going to have a policy of not exporting extremism, that's going to go for all the other Gulf countries too, particularly Saudi Arabia. So there was a more balanced approach, shall we say. And I really just think it was that perhaps some in the president's circle who were new to the game weren't really very familiar with some of the geopolitical implications of this rift.
So it sounds like you're saying that the president has gotten better facts, better information, more detailed, and changed his position on it based on reality.
Well, that's what I think, John. I mean, he just learned more. And the other thing that I think happened is I think the Emir of Qatar is a straight shooter. I've seen him come here numerous times now since he was in office, and he's gotten better and better every time. I mean, he tells it like it is, and so I think the president. This is purely speculation on my part, but I think the president and some of his advisors have been impressed with the Emir, and so that always helps, as we discussed. Personal relationships are absolutely key in most of these societies, and in our own society, too.
All right, on that, we're going to leave it, and we'll have you on next week for a preview of that meeting. Ambassador Ann Patterson, President, U.S. Qatar Council, former ambassador to Egypt and Pakistan, and served as Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs in the Obama administration under the president. Ambassador, thanks for being with us, and thanks for that fabulous insight. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Always a pleasure.
The John Frederick Show.
The challenge with digital advertising is that we're competing not against our opponents. We're competing for the attention of our audience, your friends' baby photos. You're competing with your family member's birthday. Right, you're competing with what happened last weekend. And so our content's got to be good. It's got to be engaging. And in 2020, that typically means it's either new information, some kind of policy that is really new and interesting. But increasingly what we're seeing that's really working is video, and it's personal. So look at someone like Mayor Pete, right, and how successful his husband has been on social media. At the staff of an entire presidential campaign right now could be 20, 25 people. So getting content out there is very difficult. And campaigns, they need to look like a media publisher, because that's who we're competing with. President Trump not only is breaking the mold in terms of everything else, but he's really breaking the mold in terms of the way he runs campaigns. He hired a digital marketer, Brad Parscale, who, one, has no political experience to speak of, to be campaign manager. That is a huge sign that this is a digital-first election, and no Democratic campaign yet has done something that dramatic. And we're seeing it backed up in the numbers. The Republicans, and Donald Trump specifically, are outspending the entire Democratic field almost 3-1 over the first few months of 2019. And one of the things that is working for him is the simplicity of his messages. He's got a message like build the wall or the deep state that actually works for his donors. It's a fundraising message. It's a fear-based persuasion message, too. So it really does all of those three things, and it fits in a very simple Facebook ad. And so if Democrats want to compete this election, they're going to need to call the president out aggressively. And because the social platforms are increasingly pay-to-play platforms, they're going to need to launch a very aggressive effort to actually reach voters and to do it now in 2019. One of the really positive developments since 2016 and all the tumult and the Russian espionage and everything else that happened is that the social networks, particularly Facebook and Google, have really led on some transparency efforts. They're doing new restrictions to make it harder for foreign actors to even launch ad campaigns here in the States or U.S. actors to launch in other countries. They've also increased transparency so you can see what campaigns are doing. This is really about micro-targeting. If you look at time spent, even Facebook, which is getting a little bit older compared to something like Instagram or Snapchat, by and large, the people that use it most are still those younger demographics. So more money in total is being spent in 18 to 34. But really, that's not necessarily a good use of money. Voters on the whole skew older. They skew more educated. And unfortunately, they're skewing more white. Frankly, my mother has more time to spend on Facebook looking at photos of her grandson, right, than, you know, many people do mid-career while they're at the office. Today, digital really has the ability to reach everyone and to do it very cost-efficiently. And this is one of the real advantages of digital marketing, is that we can really target just the individuals we think are likely to vote.